Hare Krishna. I have somebody else here, as you probably notice. You are very lucky tonight to be in the presence. Such a great devotee. Ajwalamukhi. So, Ajwalamukhi, how old are you?
I am 33.
33. And how long have you been a devotee?
Still trying to be one.
So can you tell us something about yourself?
Well, my parents are Prabhupada disciples, and I grew up in a number of places, in Detroit, in California, Gitanagri, Pennsylvania, went to Europe.
And that was all before she was five.
No, I went to Europe when I was, I think, 18.
That was a Yadunath joke. You know, I said, can you tell us about yourself? Well, I was in India, then I was in Chicago, and then I was in Detroit, and then I was in Alachua, then we moved to LA, and then I turned six.
Yeah.
That's a normal life if you grow up in ISKCON, the Hare Krishna movement.
So we did move around quite a bit. Definitely. I think we moved like 10 times or something before I was, I don't even know. Yeah, we moved a lot. And we continued moving, still moving, trying to move.
And now how long have you been in Alachua?
About a year and a half.
So it's been in Alachua a year and a half. So I thought you would all benefit from her presence and her, you know, it's nice to hear from someone who grew up as a devotee, to get their perspective. And, you know, we're talking about Vaishnava relationships, and I wanted to start by telling a story which I told when we were doing the forgiveness class, but I doubt that you all remember it, and I doubt that you were all here. Some of you were here, but not all of you. And this is a story about appreciating devotees. And last week, Madan Mohan mentioned how we can get something from every devotee. And he said, every devotee's got some quality that's special and that we can benefit from. And then I was talking weeks ago how even if you don't like a devotee, if you try to find something about them that's good, that you can benefit from, you'll see that. So rather than having a negative thought about them, you have a positive thought. Because what's the use of having negative thoughts about another devotee? It's only detrimental. And so there were two devotees, and they were traveling, I think, in North Dakota. They were from Los Angeles, and they were distributing Prabhupada's books. Somewhere in North Dakota or somewhere in the Midwest, far, far from any temples. Just two devotees in a van traveling, probably sleeping in the van or sleeping in a hotel or both. So the way it would work is the devotee who was driving would drop one devotee off at a store or a mall and say, I will come back tonight at 7 o'clock and pick you up. And that devotee would have a box of books, and then he would spend the whole day alone distributing books. And then the other devotee would come. That was before they had cell phones. So there's really no way to get in touch with one another, if you could imagine, all of those who are not that old.
Praying to Paramatma.
Yeah, it's like, you can't imagine. I mean, could you imagine? If you grew up with cell phones, you can't imagine how you could like get dropped off without a phone and no way to contact this person in the middle of a city, you know, 2,500 miles from where you live. So anyway, so that was normal. We'd just get dropped off. And so the other devotee, he would drive somewhere else to another parking lot, another area of town, and he would distribute books, and then he would come back to the designated location at the designated time, which he did, and lo and behold, the devotee wasn't there. And, you know, he drove around the parking lot, thought, well, maybe he decided to go to the parking lot across the street because there weren't a lot of people at this lot or whatever. So, you know, he was driving around lot to lot in that area. Couldn't find him. Couldn't find this devotee. So let me preface this story first by telling you that these devotees did not get along. And the reason they did not get along was the very reason that Prabhupada said devotees don't get along. He said the reason you don't get along is because you want to be what? Now, we mentioned this last week, so all of you out there have a chance to answer this again. We don't get along. The reason we fight is because we all want to be. I think Mitra got it last time. So what's the answer? We all want to be Krishna. Yeah, Mitra, you're right. On top of it again. So we all want to be Krishna, all want to be God. In this particular case, the way it works in our movement, it's usually if you're doing any kind of work, or the way it works anywhere, if you're doing any kind of work, somebody is normally in charge and somebody normally follows. The problem is the devotee who was following didn't want to follow, and the devotee who was in charge didn't want to follow. So he wasn't ready to switch roles. So basically they both wanted to be in charge, and the devotee who was following disagreed with the way the devotee who was in charge was doing things. That created a lot of friction. It was very unpleasant. So these two people were like some miserable couple together, right? Full of friction, you know. So anyway, that's the preface of the story. So now the devotee who's in charge is looking for the other devotee and can't find him. And both of these devotees are young men, yeah, probably in their mid-20s, and probably been devotees just a few years. So now there he is. He's stuck in this city. It's like 7:30. And he begins thinking. And this is how he was thinking. Oh my God. What if I don't find him? I'm in this city alone. I could get into a lot of trouble. I could fall into Maya because I'm alone. There's no one around, no one to see me. My mind could take over. I could end up in a bar. I could end up visiting a prostitute. I could just, who knows what, I could end up finding drugs. All these thoughts were going through his mind. And he was really afraid, thinking, he wasn't thinking, I wonder what happened to so-and-so. He was worried about himself.
Mm-hmm. So whatever works.
Self-preservation, right? Save yourself first. So anyway, all these thoughts were going through his mind. And he was obviously beginning to appreciate the value of this person that he kind of couldn't stand being with for the last week or two, that this person was actually saving him from the potential of falling into some horrible situation out in the middle of North Dakota, 2,500 miles from his Hare Krishna temple and probably 500 miles or more from local temple. So that just, you know, we take devotees for granted, and it's a story of appreciation.
What, did he find him?
Yeah. And the other devotee was also thinking the same thing.
Uh-huh.
So then it was Krishna's arrangement that they would appreciate one another.
Mm.
So, do you ever have an experience like that, or in which you took someone for granted and then you realized how, or you even dislike them and you realize, well, how much you really get from them? Even sometimes it's a little painful. Or, yeah, that's just like my husband. Yeah, no.
I try to get along mostly with people and appreciate their good qualities, and there's only been maybe two or three people that I just like really went the wrong way with. And in those cases, I just sort of removed myself from the situation and tried to pray to Krishna to really help me think of them, you know, pray for them in a way where I could overcome that situation. But as far as like really
realizing... You removed yourself so you wouldn't make an offense, or...
Protect
your sanity.
Well, yeah, protecting the sanity, and it was just, you know, we were living in a situation where we couldn't continue unless that relationship was a functional one, and it wasn't. So we just removed ourselves from it. Actually, that's probably why, very interestingly, I just got that idea. That's probably why we move so often growing up.
You think so?
Because, yeah, actually, I think that's why, because we would be, you know, doing devotional service in the early days, and like you said, you know, people were all of 20-something, early 20s, and had maybe a couple years experience in devotional service, so I think a lot of devotees had really sometimes, or many times, had some really strange ideas what devotional service was. And my mom likes to say, International Society for Rules and Regulations. And she would say, like, the pecking order used to be, like, you know, it was Supreme Personality of Godhead, then, you know, Parampara, Srila Prabhupada, you know, the the GBC, then the temple president, vice temple president's wife, temple president's kids, temple president's dog, and so on. There was this really this pecking order mentality there. And if you joined, I've heard numerous stories of people who've joined, you know, they were, you know, a whopping couple months older than someone, and they immediately felt that they were, you know, superior because they obviously knew much more than that other person. So fortunately, or you know, or unfortunately, that's just what happened. And we did move around a lot just to, I think, I guess I'd have to ask my parents that one, but we found our way somehow or other. And
well, anyway, it's a good point. You know, there was a devotee who wanted to live near a temple. Mm. But she couldn't. And she was writing her spiritual master and expressing her anxiety. And he said, well, I guess he understood her mentality and situation. He said, for you, if you live near the temple, then you may take it for granted and you may take the devotees for granted. But if you live a little bit away, then you'll always be thinking of the devotees and thinking of the temple and thinking...
Well, I do have an experience. When I was, we had moved away from the temples in the early, I guess, middle 80s sometime, maybe later 80s, just because of circumstances. And then the closest temple was 2 hours away, and so we went to the temple just for big festivals. And then later, after being away, you know, really being away for, you know, my whole teenage years, when I went to Europe, finally, Krishna played a trick on me, and I met devotees the first day I was there, kind of. It's very interesting. The best friend of my host sister, I was an exchange student, the best friend of my host sister was very interested in Hare Krishnas, and I'd filled out on the dotted line, you know, where it says religion, what religion are you? I put Hare Krishna, so nobody wanted to take me. I was homeless for 2 weeks. But then when they finally
really?
Did me, yeah. I mean, I was at the camp, the last one to be adopted. But anyhow, she was very interested in devotees and kept asking me all these questions. And then when there was a school program with devotees, two devotees came there to the school where I was at. And that's how I met devotees in Sweden for the first time after many years of not being around ISKCON. And when I went to the preaching center close by, that's when I really started realizing how important devotee association really was, because for me, growing up, it was just such a part of who I was, you know, the incense and Prabhupada's voice and just that culture. And then being removed from that and then finally coming and experiencing centrally all of those sights and sounds of a temple, even though it was just a tiny little basement, it wasn't even a temple, it was just a little preaching center, then I just had this really deep, moving experience of gratitude that, you know, somebody was sticking their neck out in the middle of this tiny little frozen town up north Sweden to try to do some preaching, you know. And I realized that a lot of our issues, I think, as a family had come from just not being around devotee association.
So, a lot of appreciation.
A lot of gratitude, yeah.
That's very important. I was having that same experience. This past weekend, I did two workshops, one for devotees and one for non-devotees. Or people, not that they weren't devotees, but not Hare Krishna devotees, per se. And it made me appreciate the devotees a lot. Because in doing the forgiveness workshop, I saw how much more open the devotees were to do it, and how much harder it was for people who weren't practicing bhakti to really open their heart. And at the end of it, you get this tremendous appreciation for devotees and their willingness and openness to look at their defects, to move forward in their relationship with Krishna and put other things aside, even though they may be attached, or even though it may be difficult, but for Krishna they'll do it. And there was just this immense appreciation for being with devotees and doing workshops with the devotees and helping devotees, because they're so, they get so much from it.
Well, it's really part of our practice, I think. Even when, recently, I got into a sort of a difficult exchange with someone, a devotee, and even though the initial response is, the false ego wants to go, but then
shoot them, hit them in the head,
etc. As a devotee, you're trained to think, okay, wait a minute, that's the false ego. Okay, whoa, and then not act on that urge of anger, and then try to see, okay, well, how do I, how do I have to be the servant of the servant here? Oh, I really don't want to be the servant of the servant. How do I do that? So I think it's just part of our training. So even though you may run into the most arrogant, puffed up devotee, they're nothing compared to your average materialist. Absolutely.
At least the devotee, in other words, you're saying, at least devotees have, there's something there. They may be acting one way, but behind it, there's
intelligence. Even if they, they act towards you, dismissing whatever. Or whatever, that same day they're going to go home, go to sleep, and they're going to be thinking what they did wrong. Yeah. Or maybe it'll take them a couple of days.
Or another thing that's really sweet also, that sometimes we may have hurt another devotee and we're not even aware of it, and that devotee may have forgiven us, and they don't want to tell us because they might feel, well, I don't want to tell them that you hurt me because you probably don't feel that you did. And so devotees may be forgiving us, they may even be praying for us, and we don't even know it. And it may be that very same devotee that we have an issue with that could be thinking of us in a very positive and prayerful way.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Actually, I had a really difficult experience one time. I was just so angry with some devotee for almost, I don't even know, it's maybe almost 2 years. I was really angry.
Wow.
It's really long.
2 years, you hear that?
It was a long time. I managed to keep that rotten potato.
Watch out.
If you don't know about the rotten potato, you have to take his forgiveness seminar.
I think we told the class.
But anyhow, so I carried that one around for a while, and it was painful for me, and I didn't know how to get rid of it. I was praying, I was trying, and I wasn't in a position to, actually just work it out with this person. So I had asked a visiting sannyasi, Indradumna Swami, about how to deal with this in my heart, because it was causing me pain, So he said, well, did you offend that devotee, or did that devotee offend you? And I was like, oh, well, he offended me. And because in one sense that was, you're laughing, because obviously that's my point of view. But it's sometimes interesting.
You were offended, we know that much.
Yes. But it's interesting that sometimes I was trying to forgive him for something that I didn't do. It's an important part of the whole process to recognize that somebody does have a responsibility and not try to falsely put everything on yourself. That's important, So I was like, "Oh, okay. Yeah, right. Yeah, he should." But then from there, he should, ask for forgiveness, but he probably won't. So how do I deal with it from here? And then he said, at the end of our conversation, he said, wow, I can see that you're really suffering with this. I'll pray for you. And I had this amazing experience the next morning where I was in the shower, and all of a sudden when I thought of that devotee, usually when I thought of that devotee, I was like, shh, and really upset. And I thought of him, and there was nothing, just nothing
amazing
at all in my heart. And I went, wow. That's power. You ask for if something that's so deep in your heart, you can't get rid of it, and I couldn't interface with that person. So that senior devotee who was, very surrendered to Krishna, prayed on my behalf, and it was lifted from my heart, and it's never been there again.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
This reminds me of a devotee. Sometimes I believe he may have been on the show or participating. And he sent me an email, and he said, another devotee and I decided to pray for one another. And we just made an agreement that we would pray for one another. And he said it's extremely powerful, and it's really working. Mm-hmm. And I was just talking to a friend of mine, Archana Siddhi, who also does japa workshops with me, and we did an online class in forgiveness, and she said there are a lot There's lots of literature out there now that is kind of like scientifically documenting the power of prayer, mm-hmm. and maybe breaking it down a little more to an empirical science where you can analyze it and see how it's working. So at the end of the seminar, I didn't do this with the devotees, I didn't have time, but at the end of the seminar that I did on Sunday in Atlanta for non-devotees, I asked every partner, because we all had groups, if you would pray for that person afterwards. And, you know, so it's true. I guess you could say we could ask any devotee to pray for us. Mm-hmm. Like any devotee you see, can you pray for me? And that way, I think you can also appreciate devotees, that these are people who Krishna will listen to.
Yeah.
And there's a nice story, a devotee named Shivananda was taking a walk with Srila Prabhupada. And then they sat down on the bench. This was in Germany, probably in 1969. They sat down on the bench, and then Prabhupada turned to Shivananda and said, "Will you pray to Krishna for me?" And Shivananda was in a state of shock. Could you imagine? You're sitting next to Srila Prabhupada, and he says, "Jwala, would you pray for me?" And so naturally, Shivananda said, "How can I pray for you, Prabhupada?" And Prabhupada said, "You're a devotee. Krishna will hear you." So I think that's wonderful.
I had a question for you.
Yes.
How do you pray for someone? Like I've recently been involved with situations where sometimes you really wish that the person would do the best thing for them, and that thing called free will just comes up and they don't. And
is this in relation to how they're dealing with you, or just dealing with themselves?
Dealing with them, well, other people.
Okay.
Not particularly myself. I'm not. It wasn't my relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered, how does it work when you know, you go in front of the deities and you ask Krishna, please inspire that person to act, and then you say whatever it is that you want it to say, but. Or should you just sort of ask Krishna to, you know, do the best thing for them? I guess I'm trying to understand the intricacies of free will and karma and the whole devotee package. How does that affect? Like, for example, someone was asking me, you know, is it just beyond that person's ability karmically, beyond their capacity to do the right thing here? You know, are they just not able to do that, you know, because of their karmic load, or is it actually possible, you know, that they could do it?
Well, you could. You know, when you're praying, in a sense, the principle of prayer is that it wouldn't matter if it's beyond their karmic load, because you could pray for them to do what's not possible ordinarily. I mean, that's the idea of prayer. There is there's a statement by Srila Prabhupada, everything is possible by Krishna's grace. So if you go through Prabhupada's books, you'll find this statement something like 800 times or 500 times. You know, by Krishna's grace, everything is possible. And then he's relating it to particular situations. So obviously we could relate it to this, you know. By Krishna's grace, everything is possible. So part of everything is that this is my karma, this is my nature. Mm-hmm. But by Krishna's grace, it can change. And I think that's true for everyone who becomes a devotee. To some degree, they change, and then they kind of run into a wall at a certain point, and then they might say, "This is all I can do." And this is all I can do. It's like Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. I can't do this on my own. But because everything's possible by Krishna's grace, and maybe they're not praying enough, so you pray for them to Krishna.
Does that mean that they have to want to change, or can you ask Krishna to make them want to change? Because we all know that we can't change other people.
One of the things that Srila Prabhupada used to say to us was that I'm always praying to Krishna for your advancement. So in that sense, you could say we can advance beyond our own will or desire to advance by the grace of a higher Vaishnava who is praying for us to advance. And how that helps, well, if I'm praying to help this person to Krishna to help this person advance, then Krishna will have to remove some of the obstacles on the path.
Mm.
Should you pray for a particular obstacle, that may be a case-to-case thing. It may, because you might think, well, I don't know if that's the real obstacle.
That's true.
My perception. So you could say, Krishna, please help this person. Or something, maybe, the person may be an alcoholic, so you know that's the obstacle. So you can pray, Krishna, please help this person. And, you know, we have the example of Prabhupada's sister. Her husband was a drunkard, but she never divorced him, and she remained a devotee, obviously praying for him, and eventually he came back. So there's a Christian book called The Power of the Praying Wife.
Wow.
You know, so the wife praying for the husband, the wife praying for the children. So I think a lot of times that's all you can do is pray. You can't, you see this person and it seems they're incorrigible, and all you can really do is pray to Krishna to help them understand what's the obstacle and give them the intelligence to be able to, and determination to be able to overcome it. So praying for other people is very powerful. And there's one person, I don't know who said it, but it's right in line with Vaishnavism. He said that if you're too caught up in your own pain or your own self of your own needs, you can't really feel the needs of another. You can't feel compassion because it's all about you, and I don't have enough, and I'm suffering because I don't have enough, and this isn't right, and so forth. So when we go beyond that and pray for other people, it's very, very elevating, as opposed to even praying for ourselves. Not that we shouldn't pray for ourselves, but when we take it beyond. Then, I'll tell you a nice story. It's really. But first, we have a comment from Bhakti and Carol, who says, fiancé and I were walking through a grocery store. We passed some people eating what? From fried, you mean? Oh, eating chip from chicken bones. Fiancé made a horrible face and cringed. Such an automatic response. It was not staged. I was so grateful then to be there with him. For the moment, I forgot any other problems. It is good to be... In other words, you're saying you kind of didn't notice that how bad that was. And yeah. A devotee is one who reminds you of Krishna.
Mm.
So, I said I was going to tell a story. What did I say?
Yeah, you did.
No, I forgot the story. It's all your fault, Carol. I forgot the story. So what was the last thing I said before the story?
You were talking about the power of prayer.
Power of prayer.
And how when you pray for other people, because when you're so caught up in your own pain.
I remember... I don't know, it may be Jiva Goswami who explained this, said that, well, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, Krishna, how does Krishna know who to give mercy to? Well, wherever the devotee directs it and says, Krishna, please give mercy to this person. So then Krishna's mercy will come wherever the devotee directs it. So a devotee's thinking of somebody and says, can you give this person mercy? Then Krishna will give it. So the story is that Prahlad Maharaj wanted to save everyone in the universe. That was his desire. So it is said that you can only save the people or only pray for the people that you know, because you have to think, because your mercy can only go, Krishna can only give the mercy, but this is how he gives his mercy. He gives it through the devotee, and so the devotee directs it. So the devotee can only direct it to those he knows. Like Krishna, give the mercy to who? No, I can't give to everybody because you have to set your mind on who it is. But it was Prahlad Maharaj's desire, so Krishna made an arrangement. So he enacted this pastime of Prahlad Maharaj and Lord Nrisimhadev coming and saving him. And at the end of that story in the Bhagavatam, it says, whoever reads this story will be liberated. And that way Prahlad Maharaj had his desire fulfilled, that everyone would be liberated. So Krishna fulfilled Prahlad Maharaj's desire. Prahlad Maharaj wanted to liberate everyone, pray for everyone.
And we have to get that on the big screen.
Yeah, that would be a nice story. and part of that story was that the devotee is more compassionate than Krishna, because the devotee comes in the material world and experiences suffering, so he can empathize with the suffering of others. But Krishna doesn't suffer, so the devotee can empathize more. So the devotee is the real conduit for mercy.
Wow.
So... So, but The point I was making is that the idea of praying for somebody is so purifying. We do this in the workshops. I always like to do this in the Japa retreats. We all pray for one another. And after that, you can see there's a shift in the consciousness of the whole room, because now we're taking our consciousness off ourselves, and we're offering prayers to others. And in the forgiveness workshops, we ask the participants to pray for the well-being of the person who hurt them. And obviously for some people that's difficult, but for everybody it's liberating, because it's you know, prayer and blessings is the antithesis of hate. And so we come in with an issue with someone.
Or envy even, yeah.
Yeah, or envy, resentment, revenge, jealousy.
Yeah.
So, now, would you like to hear something funny, Bhaktin Carol? Yes, you would. Okay. Hare Krishna to every soul from Gopinath. And the same from... Bhaktin Carol said she chanted for the person who hurt me. Yes, very nice. See, Bhaktin Carol is the incarnation of Mother Teresa. The stories that she has are just incredible. So, I was with a devotee. He's a very funny devotee, and he liked to help other people become Krishna conscious. So, when we would go shopping, he had a plan to help people become Krishna conscious, or we'd be in an elevator or something, and he would be talking to me. This was all staged. He'd be talking to me very loudly, and he's from New York, and he had this thick New York accent. And he would do something like this. Did you hear about what I... Did you read the paper? Did you hear about it? And I go, no, what? And he goes, they're putting animals in the meat. And I go, what? He goes, yeah, they're putting animals in the meat. I go, really? He goes, yeah, I read it in the paper. They're putting animals in the meat. And he'd say it real loud. And one time we were in an elevator. So everybody had to hear it. And I had to keep a straight face. And all the people are going... Oh my God, they're putting animals in. Yeah, I read in the paper, they're putting animals in the meat. And then once in a while people would say, wait a minute, isn't meat an animal? And he'd go, oh, I never thought of that. Oh, I'm not going to eat meat again. Yuck, I didn't realize that. You know, and everybody would kind of like look around puzzled and they wouldn't know what to say. So that was his preaching technique.
Did it work?
Yeah. Sometimes. Yeah, it was just a way to get conversation going. You all out there can try it tomorrow when you go shopping with your friend. Try that.
Well, we actually did one time. I remember in Sweden we had a radio show program, and people went around and interviewed. One person would go, devotee would take the microphone and go interview people on the sidewalk. And I repeated this when I went to the Czech Republic. And it was really funny, the responses you got from people. So we'll just pretend. Here we go. See if I don't want to mess this up. Hi, how are you today?
Very good.
Very good. Are animals your friends?
Yes.
Are you a friend to your... Are animals your friends? Are you a friend... shoot! Animals your friends? Are you a friend to the animals? Are you a friend to the animals?
Yes.
Do you eat your friends?
What do you mean? I mean, I don't eat my friends. And, oh, yeah, I get it. Oh,
yeah, yeah. So a lot of people would be like what you did. And then, of course, and then a lot of people would be like, yeah, I eat my friends. Yeah, they're tasty with ketchup and that kind of stuff. But, yeah, people just don't realize.
Yeah. Anyway, we got sidetracked there. Now, Bhaktin Carol says, a devotee suggested to me, and it was difficult at first, but they understood and did it. So we're talking about praying for devotees. So, I mean, you, if you understand the position of compassion in spiritual advancement, then you understand how important it is to pray for others, especially praying for those that have hurt you. Srila Prabhupada, he talks about Lord Shiva as being compassionate. Mm. And in there he says that compassion is the highest quality of a spiritualist, because there's some spiritualists that are very into peace and, you know, personal peace, which is really the Buddhist path, is, you know, to attain this stillness, thoughtlessness, this mindless mindfulness, just this sense of being and consciousness, and what the Buddha say, enjoy the peace. You know, some people are peaceful, they don't know how to enjoy the peace, or like teenagers, you know, they can't enjoy peace. They can only enjoy action. You know, if it's too peaceful, it gets boring. So that's the Buddhism, you know, kind of enjoy the peace, make the mind empty. So, what was I saying? I got so excited I forgot. We're talking about, compassion. So Prabhupada talks about, you know, these kinds of spiritualists who are very into experiencing spirituality, or very, very much into focusing on elevation, liberation, and they're called salvationists. Their concern is salvation, their personal salvation. And then we have the example of Prahlad Maharaj, and he offers a prayer to Krishna, and he says, I am happy because I am absorbed in thinking of you. My consciousness is absorbed in thinking of you, and he said, I have no problems. Mm-hmm. Like, you go to Jamaica, they have the thing, Jamaica, no problem. This is Prahlad Maharaj, no problem. He says, I have no problems because I'm always hearing and chanting about you. Mm-hmm. But I do have an anxiety. I do have a soche, tato, vimukta-che, that's a indriyartam. My anxiety is that other people aren't happy. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, our world today is so bad. People are, they used to be called citizens, now they're called consumers.
Actually, you know, they're actually called this whole eugenics thing, not to be discussing politics, but they call people useless feeders.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Philosophy that the world's overpopulated and
yeah.
You just...
Well, you know, from the business point of view, you know, like business dominates this culture. So now we used to be citizens, now we're all consumers. So now we have identity as consumers, and consuming is good because if you consume the economy, it helps the economy. And so we have a whole generation of people who've grown up to be honored as consumers, and part of that identity comes the myth or the belief that I need more. So now with everybody thinking I need more, it's extremely self-centered. You know, the average person, if you ask them, do you have enough money? He'll say, I need 30% more, I'll be okay. Average guy on the street, you know, making $50,000 a year, be okay if I were making 75. The guy with 75 would be okay if I was making 105. The guy with 1 million, be okay with 1.3. The guy with 1 billion, and you won't believe this, I'll be okay with 1.3. Everybody's bought into that idea. So then they have this 30, you know, there's not enough. More is better. So then we have this phenomena in America. This is the most amazing thing, and you're probably not aware of it, of these gated community apartment complexes called storage units. They're gated communities with many apartments, right? And these are apartments for what? For all the stuff we can't fit in our garage or house, right? Now, it's interesting that Americans have so much stuff that they have to rent apartments to put their stuff in. So we have these gated apartment communities, right? And at the same time, we have how many people? Million? Billion? How many people who don't have homes? But Americans have homes for the stuff they don't need. So you just try to understand what's happening here. That our culture has ingrained myths about money and acquisition to the point that everybody's dissatisfied. Nobody's satisfied. And then there's this other myth that you never have enough. It's just, you know, more is better, and there's scarcity everywhere. Don't have enough money. I don't have enough strength. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough friends. I don't have enough. I didn't get enough sleep. Don't have enough time to read. You know, it's like, so now we grow up in that culture, and how many people are really that concerned about others because we're so self-consumed with the latest iPod. You know, you got to get it. You know, especially you got to get the first 100 are going to be blue. So you got to get the first. You got to be
it's
one of
sort of
them.
Like, what was it, that shopping day not too long ago? I forget what they call it. That big shopping day.
The iPod day?
Black Wednesday or whatever.
Black Friday.
I'm not a shopper. No. I don't know.
When's but, that? It's the day after Thanksgiving?
Yeah, I think so. There was a man, it was on the news, he was killed because he was the security guard at Walmart. And
well, they opened at 5 that morning.
Well, the crowd of people was pressing so hard against the, you know, the glass doors that the whole wall fell in, and it wouldn't have killed him, but they ran over, this whole crowd of people just ran over him to go and get the, so they could get the best deals on stuff, and they crushed this man.
Okay, very good point. Don't lose track of what we're talking about, because we're on track here. I'm not going to forget.
Sorry.
It's working. No, so this is a good point. It's exactly in line with what I wanted to say next. Our culture has another myth. And you may not be aware of this myth, but you'll be aware of it once we discuss it. In our culture, there's another myth. And that myth is money is more important than relationships.
Yes.
Big boo-boo. Divorce over money. People are killed over money. Sibling rivalry over inheritances. Friends. What happens to friends become enemies when they do business together, when one borrows money, doesn't pay it back. Money is more important than relationships. Do you think when money was first developed, they had any idea it was going to end up like this? You know why money was developed? It was developed because they were bartering and it was too complicated, you know, to bring three pigs over to get, you know, a barrel of apples and, you know, two, you know. So they said, well, let's use money, right? So the concept wasn't that they're going to be people who had billions of dollars and people with only had a few hundred or nothing. It was just, you know, everybody did a service and they got rewarded for it.
Well, you know, that's actually in Bhagavatam, why that phenomenon is so. With that story of Maharaj Parikshit and the
hoarding of gold, yeah.
Well, as I remember it, tell me if I'm remembering wrong, is that the story in Bhagavatam when Maharaj Parikshit finds Kali beating Dharma the bull, then he wants to kill him, but then Kali very craftily says, give me shelter. So he says, well, you know, you can go wherever, you know, the four sinful activities are taking place. He said, well, nowhere in your kingdom are any of these things taking place. So he said, well, then you can go where there is gold as well.
Hoarding of gold, yeah, because then there'll be
all of those things.
Meat eating, illicit sex, gambling, yeah, intoxication. Yeah, so that's interesting.
It's a good thing we can't hoard gold in America. The Federal Reserve doesn't have any.
The yogis know how to make gold. They drink. What do? They drink. There's a process where they drink some kind of poisonous metal and they urinate out gold.
Mercury, actually.
Mercury. And then if they urinate it on metal, it turns to gold. And
something. We don't try that at home.
Yeah. If it works, I'll take 20% of your profits. Okay. So the whole reason I'm talking about this is just to show what our culture has become. And statistically, they say we get 30,000 messages a day through the media. If you expose yourself to the media, you get 30,000 messages a day to consume. So now we're caught up in this. I don't have enough because my cell phone only does 47 things and your cell phone does 127. So I'm like in total anxiety right now that I don't have one. So I'm going to work extra hours so I can get your cell phone. And you're wearing these $400 Nike shoes and mine are only 120 and I'm in like total anxiety. I got to get those Nike shoes of yours that you've got or I'm going to get better ones. So this is the culture. And then we learn that for a Vaishnava, the highest position of Vaishnava is to be compassionate, to feel the suffering of others, to be compassionate, to give them. How can we feel that way if we're totally consumed in, you know, there's not enough. My house is only 1,600 square feet. It's not enough. I need 2,100 square feet. We'll get a 2,100 square feet. It won't be enough. You'll want a 2,700 square feet. And to get 2,700 square feet, you can fill up three rooms that you don't need full of junk and you don't have to rent a storage unit. You know, and then you can, you know, it's just like, is it going to end? It's called the mode of passion, you know. So if we want to, you know, really understand relationships, there's got to be time and energy for other people.
Right.
And if we're so consumed with what we don't have and what we need and what's lacking, then there's no gratefulness. There's no there's no satisfaction. There's never enough. Yeah. You know, more is better.
I heard a nice story. Sachinandan Swami was telling about one time he was in Vrindavan, and he was talking to one local farmer there. They were standing on the raised platform in front of his paddy, rice paddy field. And he was asking the farmer what he does, you know. And the farmer was answering how he, you know, he's describing the process of all of his different farming practices. And Sachinandan Swami, he said in his heart he was feeling, I shouldn't say this story so boldly, I hope I remember all the details, but he was saying that he was feeling like, yeah, you know, this farmer, he's just working so hard all the day, I'm, you know, chanting and hearing and doing the Vaishnava thing and like that. And so the farmer was describing all the hard work that goes into Vav. And he said, then I work, I think he worked something like 2 months out of the year, maybe, I think it was 2 months. He said, and then the rest of the year I do puja. So, you know, and then he was like, oh, wow. So really, I was actually meditating on that since moving here to Alachua.
How to work for 2 months and do puja for 10?
Kind of, but just simplifying, because we moved here from a big city, and just realizing how much, if I compare the quality of my life from when I was living 8 years in this big city to now living in the middle of a field, you know, the same worries and the same anxieties are there. The same stuff is, you know, I have much less stuff. But really, it's all about just our consciousness while we're doing it. And you actually have to make time. You really have to make time, like Prabhupada says again and again. Somehow mold your life in a way where you can hear and chant, because all those other activities that we spend so much time doing so that we can hear and chant. Oh, if I get this and get this done and get that done, then I'll have time and peace. Then I'll be happy, right? They never come.
You know, in the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada describes it as the self-created burden, you know, weaving our web. So I think it's a good point also, just in terms of relationships, because it takes time to cultivate a relationship, and it takes time to give yourself to people. And if you don't have time, you can't really give yourself to people. And you see, like Prabhupada said, a guru has no private life. You know, his life is for everybody. That's the position of guru. It's like when you become a sannyasi. I mean, obviously sannyasis, they may go away, they may go do their bhajan, chant, you know, go to Govardhan or go to Vrindavan. But in general, most of your life, it's for other people. That's what it means. And if your life is so complicated and you're so, and you become too much self-absorbed in the, I don't have enough, I have more program, how can you give yourself to others? You won't want to.
Yeah, so one of those self-sufficiency farms coming around.
When we give up the stuff,
and the cell phone,
and when you give yourself to others, others will give themselves to you. And so when we talk about relationships, the more you're friendly, the more you become a friend, the more friends you'll have. Mm. So the more, so that's, you know, it's good to be in that attitude of not expect, because more is not, you know, there's not enough is also, I don't have enough friends. And so, you know, you want to have a lot of friends. Well, just be the friend. You know, always being in that attitude. You know, well, why am I expecting? You know,
be the friend you want to have in the world.
Yeah, exactly. I had a really amazing realization the last few days. I you know, when I do the forgiveness workshops, I also have to look at my own issues. You know, so I was looking at the issues of people who I had worked with or been with who left me. And there were a number of them, like three or four, you know, that I remember. And I was trying to think, why? Why was this happening? How was I involved in any way in them leaving me? And then I realized that I was with one of them, and I really wasn't happy, and I was always trying to get away from it. And that person eventually left. I was with another one, and I came to the point where I also wanted to get away with it. Away from it, and that person left. I was with another one, and I was disturbed by what this person was doing, and I left working with that person, and I came back, and then later they left, they left the project and it fell on my lap. So I was just going on each time, and, you know, instead of like looking, what's wrong with these people? But I never became their proper friend or partner, and so then I got that was what Krishna gave me, that I was leaving. So then they ended up leaving me.
In a sense of a project that you were looking at?
A project or a relationship. Or ending a relationship or ending a close relationship.
Because you just didn't want to deal with it?
Because, you know, it was more an internal thing that I didn't want to get close, or I didn't want to make it last. And so it wasn't like a conscious thing that I'm leaving you. It was just like they weren't there anymore. The relationship dissolved naturally because of my own, not because of what I was doing, but more because of what I was thinking.
So are you saying that the relationships we have, you have to be really conscious of what your intentions are? Or?
Yeah, and what you're giving into it, even what you're thinking. Because if you're thinking, I don't like this, or I don't like being with this person, you may communicate that to that person mentally, and that person will get it, and that person may not be there.
Mm.
So in any, you know, if we take that in terms of relationships with the devotees, and say, I don't like this devotee, so they'll never, so how, you're thinking in your mind, I don't like this devotee, how will you ever have a good relationship?
Right.
And so it's some way we want to think how we can like them and have the good relationship, because what we're thinking about a person is affecting it.
Can I share with you one last
yes.
thing? I had this realization many years ago now. Maybe 8-9 years ago. And I got this from being in India. I was there, and I stayed in Bombay for a month. And I realized from the association there that if you remember just this one thing, whatever relationship problem you're having, you can resolve with just this one thing, is that I am the servant of the servant of the servant of the servant of the person in front of me.
Mm.
Like that.
Very nice. And why wouldn't we want to be the servant?
Only because of envy.
Yeah. So that's... You know, another thing that I think is really difficult is that when we hear these things, and then we hear them again and again and again, we come to a point where we think, okay.
I know that. Right?
I know that. I've heard it. And I think one of the other valuable lessons we can take from I'm a servant of the servant of the servant of this person is that I don't understand that I'm the servant of the servant of the servant, and I should do my best to understand that I'm the servant. And how will I understand that? Well, one way I'll understand it is by acting that way.
Yeah.
At least even faking it.
Yeah, or praying to Krishna to help that actually sink in. Please let me understand my position so that I can relate properly with this person.
Yeah. Because sometimes we'll verbalize it and it doesn't mean anything. It's just kind of like we're saying it, but we're not
doing it.
We're not doing it or meaning it, or maybe even we think we mean it and we think we understand it. But always be aware that that's a, you know, to be a servant means I'm not trying to outdo this person. I'm not envious of this person. I want to help them. So it's a way of being. You know, I think that's what I'm getting at. It's like when we hear philosophy, particularly in areas like this, it's meant to take us to a way of being, not a way of understanding in our head. Because, you know, what we understand in our head, it often goes away. But a way of being is something that once you get it, it's there. You know, a lot of people will say, I understood this, or I had this experience, and from that point, there was a major change or shift in my consciousness, and the rest of my life, the problem that I had in the past would never happen again because I had this realization or understanding. So I think that's really what Krishna consciousness is, when you understand something so deeply that it changes your whole perception of the situation permanently, so that...
Yeah.
You know, so that's, you know, that's where we want to go with this whole relationship thing, in understanding how important devotees are and how if there weren't any devotees in the world, you think, well, if so many devotees bothered me, what if those devotees didn't exist? Or if those were the only devotees in the world, what would your choice be? Them or nobody? You know. So obviously you'd say, well, I'd rather be with them because at least they're devotees.
That's true.
So that way we can appreciate, even from a distance, like, at least that I need these people, even if I don't always like them, or I wouldn't choose them if I had choices of my friends, but still.
Yeah. From that point of view, even those handful of people that really bugged me, I'd choose their association in a second if
totally.
They were just
the only people
the
left.
The only people.
Yeah. So that's a very good point. Okay, what time is it out there in the material world? Is it 9 o'clock? Yeah, so I'm coming down from the spiritual world. Zoop, I found out it was just 9 o'clock. So, does anyone have any questions, comments before we go? Spiritual Sky, you always have something to say, don't you? You want to make a comment? You want to enlighten us? Get the last word in here? With some realization, or maybe Spiritual Sky went back to Spiritual Sky. Oh, Kremlin. I didn't even see you. You snuck up. You're welcome, Kremlin. Now, be nice to everybody tomorrow out there. You're welcome, Spiritual Sky. Always stay in the Spiritual Sky. Be compassionate. Be merciful. Pray for people. Pray for devotees. Don't think you need more stuff. You know, just think how many books you could buy if you're not so concerned about getting the latest iPhone or something. You could save a few $100 and buy some books and distribute them. You know, that's what the world needs. Okay, thank you all. We'll see you next week. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.